Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In 2007, 12,000 inmates with mental illness sued the Illinois Department of Corrections, alleging that the agency punishes inmates with mental illness instead of properly treating them. A settlement was reached 9 years later when the state agreed to revamp mental health care and provide better treatment. But managing mental health treatments in prisons remains a challenge in Illinois and across the country, including Ohio, where the problems are exacerbated by overcrowding and a shortage of mental health professionals. This is what we're talking about today. Listeners, the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Correction declined our invitation to join the show. David Singleton is executive director and attorney at Ohio Justice and Policy Center, which advocates on behalf of people affected by the criminal justice system. He joins us by phone. Welcome back.
Good morning. I'm glad to be here. Thank you, Ann.
Christine Herman is a reporter for Illinois Public Media in Urbana, Illinois. She recently reported on how Illinois manages its mentally ill prison population, and she joins us by phone as well. Welcome, Christine Herman.
Thanks so much, Ann. It's good to be here.
You wrote about or reported about Ashur Rasho, who has spent more than half of his life alone in a prison cell in Illinois. Give us a thumbnail on his life.
Yeah, so he was initially arrested as a teenager in Illinois on charges of robbery and burglary. So his sentence was maybe a few years, but it ended up being extended to 26 years because of assaults on prison staff. The problem being that he has several mental health conditions, including severe depression, schizophrenia, borderline personality disorder, and he wasn't receiving adequate treatment for those illnesses. He was also placed in restrictive housing or solitary confinement where he had no meaningful social interaction and was in a small space for 22 to 24 hours a day. So those types of conditions, there's a pretty clear understanding in the mental health field that those can cause deterioration even for a healthy person. But if you're a person who has a mental illness, this can make that even more severe and cause further deterioration. And for Ashur Rasho, it manifested in violent outbursts against other inmates and against prison staff. So his sentence was extended instead of getting additional or better treatment. This is why it's this whole idea of inmates with mental illness receiving further punishment instead of treatment to help them get better.
When they were talking about extending his sentence because of behavior behind bars, did the issue of his mental illnesses come up?
I'm not sure about all the details for that, but what I know is that in the lawsuit, and it's a class action suit on behalf of him and 12,000 other inmates who are believed to have mental illness within the Illinois Department of Corrections. You know, this was the case that they made, that instead of receiving treatment for their illness, they received a further punishment. They were, taken out of, they were isolated, separated, and restricted, and they might have received medications, but overall they were treated as behavior issues instead of treated as people who have an illness. Mm-hmm.
David Singleton, does this sound familiar when we're talking about Ohio prison system?
It's very familiar. It is. What's happening in Illinois is happening in Ohio, and so much of it has to do with the fact that the prison system is ill-equipped to manage people with serious mental illness behind bars. And it's a lot to do with resources. We over-incarcerate in the state of Ohio. We have 50,000 people locked up in prisons designed for 37,000. And it's just unsustainable. And, despite the best efforts to try and provide treatment, we just don't have enough resources in Ohio to get that done in the prison system. In fact, and I think the folks who run the prison system would say they would prefer not to have people incarcerated with serious mental illness. They ought to be treated in the community, and we ought to figure out ways to keep them out of the prison system in the first place.
We're talking about people who suffer from mental illness and how it's managed or not when they are imprisoned for committing a crime. You just heard from David Singleton. He's executive director and an attorney at Ohio Justice and Policy Center. It advocates on behalf of people affected by the criminal justice system. Also with us is Christine Herman. She's a reporter for Illinois Public Media in Urbana, Illinois. She recently reported on how Illinois manages its mentally ill prison population in a class action lawsuit there. Christine, whatever became of the settlement from 2016, was anything resolved then?
So in May of 2016, the Illinois Department of Corrections finally agreed to work on changes. You know, without acknowledging fault, they agreed to hire more staff. It's a very lengthy consent decree that was issued, but essentially it boils down to hire more mental health staff so that the inmates who need treatment are able to get it. It's like it's fairly straightforward. You know, there was also, you know, language around making sure inmates are screened for mental illness and then provided a treatment plan that's tailored to their specific, you know, assessments and things along those lines. So that was the agreement, and the state has made some progress. They've hired more staff. They've done training with their corrections officers who don't have a mental health background in how to interact with inmates who have mental illness. This is what the Department of Corrections head John Baldwin has told me in an interview. But the judge has, federal judge has repeatedly stepped in to say that the care for inmates remains grossly insufficient. They've made progress in some areas, but a small fraction of the 12,000 inmates with mental illness are starting to receive what is now, you know, constitutionally adequate care, but the majority of the rest are still not. So it's slow progress.
And has anyone in Illinois ever addressed the sentencing and whether or not it takes into account mental illness at the outset? Or do they wait until there's a problem?
You know, yeah, so I'm not sure how they handle things with new inmates coming in. But what Director Baldwin did tell me is that they are starting to look at reducing the population of inmates with mental illness who are in what they call restrictive housing, which has formerly been described as solitary confinement. It's minimal social interaction that we know from mental health research leads to deterioration. They're trying to reduce that population by looking at the sentencing that has been given to those people and, when appropriate, helping phase them out. But he said there are various challenges to doing that because they also need to be appropriately staffed to make sure that when these people step down into the general population, they are able to do so in a way that's safe for both them and for the other inmates. And a lot of these problems boil down to inadequate staff. They aren't able to recruit. There's a mental health shortage everywhere.
Everywhere, right.
Just in the community. There's also a shortage of mental health staff workers in corrections because it's a very difficult job. You know, the court monitor who I spoke with said that the corrections officers themselves are traumatized from working in an environment where they face abuse and assault from inmates. But a lot of that is because the inmates aren't receiving treatment. It's kind of a vicious cycle.
David Singleton, when we talk about sentencing reform all the time, it's part of, you know, what they're talking about in the new session of the General Assembly in Ohio. Do they raise the issue of sentencing reform for people who are mentally ill?
No. That's the short answer. No. Mm-hmm. There's not a focus on diverting people from the criminal justice system who have serious mental illness. We need to be spending a lot more of our resources at the front end, making sure that there's enough dollars in the community to provide treatment to those who need it. Because, you know, the number one provider of services to mentally ill people in the state of Ohio is the prison system.
Right.
That is completely backwards. That should not be happening. And, you know, I know that folks at DRC, the Department of Rehabilitation and Correction here in Ohio, would agree with that. They don't believe that they're the right place to be providing treatment for serious and mentally ill people. So I think we need to be spending much more upfront to provide treatment in the community and keep people out of prison.
Right, because the question is, can serious mental illness be treated in a prison setting anyway? It's an ad hoc asylum, but it's not what it's built for.
It's not what it's built for, and that's why, you know, I want to temper my criticism of DRC on this, because I think they are in a tough spot. Prisons aren't places where we should be treating people with mental illness. And if I can make a prediction, I'll predict this in Illinois. Things will get better for a little bit under court supervision. And then when the court supervision goes away some years down the road, things will revert back. That's what's happened in Ohio. We had a case, Dunn versus Voinovich, in the mid-90s that resulted in some really good reforms. Mm-hmm. And some of the same things that we heard Christine talking about a minute ago in terms of making sure that folks are not isolated when they have mental illness and put in restrictive housing and making sure people get assessed and treated. And then once the court supervision goes away, the system starts to backslide. And that's what's happened in Ohio.
David, is that because it's not in statute?
I think that's part of it, and I think it's a resource issue. I mean, as reforms were being implemented in Ohio, things got better, but the prison population continued to grow. And you know, in the mid '90s, we had around 30,000 people locked up, maybe a little under that. Now we got 50. So it's just the services can't keep up with the demand. That's the problem.
So that sounds familiar then from your reporting, Christine Herman, that, yeah, things got a little bit better, but then they backslid over time.
Well, in Illinois, I mean, the mental health advocates here, the lawyers who are suing on behalf of inmates there, they're hoping that this will continue. In fact, there was a permanent injunction that was put in place by the federal judge, which basically means that they will be continuing to keep an eye on whether or not the state is complying with the changes they're supposed to make. So they're somewhat optimistic, but, you know, it is a big cost, and Illinois is, not very fiscally sound in many ways. So to invest a lot, you know, the legislature has to put forth the funding to make sure that they can hire the right staff, enough staff, and continue to work on reforms to make it a place where inmates who are here are receiving the care that they are, you know, that they are entitled to as a result of, you know, constitutional rights.
Do we know, Christine Herman, to what extent people are imprisoned for crimes that they commit as a result of their mental illness, how prevalent that is?
I haven't been able to track down that specific data, but I do know that the Department of Justice, the most recent data they have, they surveyed, they sampled prisons across the U.S. in 2011 to 2012. The most accurate The information they were able to report was that 40% of inmates reported having been told by a mental health professional that they had a mental health disorder at some point in their life. And of those who met the threshold for having serious psychological distress at the time of the survey, only about half were receiving treatment, whether that was medication or counseling or both, for their illness. So there, you know, there are tens of thousands of inmates, you know, across the country who have mental illness and who are in prison facilities where they're not receiving adequate care.
And David Singleton, what used to be the situation? I mean, why this uptick 30, 40 years ago?
Oh, in terms of why we have more people in prison with mental illness?
Right.
Oh, that you trace that right back to, you know, the 80s when there was a movement to take away funding from community mental health and the institutionalization of people from mental hospitals and flooding folks into the community without any support. That's what you can trace it to. Absolutely. And it's why we have a lot more homelessness, and it's also why we have a lot more, you know, folks in the prison system with serious mental illness.
Christine Herman, I have to say goodbye to you. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Ann. I appreciate it.
Christine Herman is a reporter for Illinois Public Media in Urbana, Illinois. She recently reported on how Illinois is managing or not its mentally ill prison population in a class action lawsuit brought on behalf of 12,000 inmates challenging the state on its protocol. David Singleton is going to stay with us. We'll be continuing our conversation. If you have some insights, if you have some thoughts about the inmate population and mental illness, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. More than half of all inmates in the United States suffer from some kind of mental illness, but managing mental health treatments in prisons remains a challenge across the country, including in Ohio, where the problems are exacerbated by overcrowding and a shortage of mental health professionals. We're talking about the quality of care for inmates with mental illness. Still by phone, executive director and attorney at Ohio Justice and Policy Center, which advocates on behalf of people affected by the criminal justice system, David Singleton. Joining us is Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness Ohio, Terry Russell. Welcome back, Terry.
Thank you, Ann.
And joining us by phone is journalist and author of the 2018 book, Insane, America's Criminal Treatment of Mental Illness, Alyssa Roth. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Listeners, we did invite the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Correction to join the show. They declined our request. Alyssa Roth, in your book, you were looking to frame the incarceration and treatment of the mentally ill as the next civil rights issue. Why that way?
Well, I think when we talk about criminal justice, we talk about the issue of race, we talk about the issue of poverty, and we haven't talked enough about the role that mental illness plays. As you said, more than half of people in jails and prisons in the United States have a mental illness, and yet these people are struggling to get the care they need, to get the treatment they need, and don't necessarily, you know, don't most of the time belong in the jails and prisons where they're ending up.
Do you know, or is there anybody that keeps track of how many people are imprisoned for crimes that they've committed as a function of their mental illness?
We know that in many cases, people are incarcerated for crimes related to their mental illness, and in some cases, it may be crimes of, you know, of how they're living. So somebody who's homeless and living on the street could be arrested for that. You could be arrested for disorderly conduct because somebody is psychotic and shouting and talking to somebody that only they can see. So, and it's hard to know exactly how many people are, you know, is it directly related to it or is it tangentially related to it? But we know that many, many people are incarcerated because of their mental illness.
And we know that more and more we're talking about other backdrops, say human trafficking, drug addiction, as issues that are getting special courts. Is there any kind of increase in the number of special courts for people who are mentally ill?
Many states have been developing mental health courts, so really specifically designed for defendants with mental illness, and they're usually tied to things like make sure that you take your medication or make sure that you go to treatment, things like that. The problem that I see with these courts is that they are they tend to be very, very small, so they only work for a very small number of defendants. And it just doesn't address the larger issue of how these people are ending up in the system.
Terry Russell, what do you what about mental health courts? Is that part of the solution, or they're just we underinvest in those as well?
Absolutely. It is part of the solution so that a person is diverted to treatment versus incarceration. And in Ohio, because of retired Supreme Court Justice Evelyn Stratton, she has been a champion around the country. But here in Ohio, we have more mental health courts than any other state. So I think that there has been some changes going on that are extremely positive to the population. But the flow of people into the prisons, we can get to later, but is unacceptable.
And David Singleton, your thoughts about mental health courts? Can they work? Do they work sometimes? What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with both Terry and Alyssa. I think that they are part of the solution, but they don't serve enough people. And that's the case, even though in Ohio we have, as Terry said, the greatest number of mental health courts in the country. The dockets still are small compared to the need for folks to be diverted. So I think it's good development. I think that they should be expanded. And in addition to that, though, I'm going to keep coming back to this. We've got to spend more money making sure that there are treatment opportunities available for people with serious mental illness.
In some places, they've actually have prisons that are devoted to treating mentally ill, whole facilities.
I think that's a terrible idea to expand those, because I think what that does is it normalizes that we should be sending people to prison to get treatment. I do think, and I do want, good treatment available for those folks who happen to be in prison with serious mental illness.
Uh-huh.
But I don't like the idea of normalizing prison as a place to provide treatment for mental illness.
Alisa Roth?
I think that the other concern is that if a well-meaning judge or district attorney or even defense attorney is looking at this defendant and saying this person needs treatment, we could divert them, but they're going to have trouble getting into treatment on the outside. But hey, we have this beautiful new facility where we're offering treatment in the jail or in the prison. Mm-hmm. We don't want that to be the preferred option as the best way to get that person into treatment.
Kyle in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Kyle.
Hi, Ann. So I'm in law school. I've worked the last 2 years for the Franklin County Public Defender. And a lot of times what we see is incarceration causes mental illness, right? So we've talked about lack of resources for handling people that committed crimes due to their mental illness. Mm-hmm. But I was wondering if we could talk about the other side, where being incarcerated and what the systemic from that actually causes mental illness and how we can handle that.
Right. Has that come up in the, at the State House, David Singleton, in the courts, anything like that, the issue of prison damaging people?
Well, it has in the context of solitary confinement, because that has been shown to damage folks and damage people in a lifelong way. So there has been a movement in Ohio, and it's across the nation, to limit the use of solitary confinement. Now, you know, one could say that in Ohio, although we don't call it solitary confinement anymore, it's restrictive housing, that for long periods of time can still be very damaging. And I've got, I represent clients who came into prison and did not have serious mental illness, and just being incarcerated and then put in, what they call the hole, it leads to all kinds of psychological and psychiatric problems. So that's a real concern, and I'm glad Kyle raised that.
Hmm. Yeah, Terry Russell?
The problem that I have, first of all, I don't know that incarceration creates the mental illness of an individual, but I do think the collateral damage of being in a prison certainly doesn't move towards any recovery of that illness. The collateral damage done to individuals that are in prisons, whether it's 1 year or for life, is it's a lifelong sentence. People with these illnesses need to come back into the community. They will come back into the community without health care, without any place to live. Matter of fact, our laws allow the discrimination for those that have been in prison not to be able to get any subsidy for housing, for example. And then you add that stigma along with their mental illness of getting a job. Gary Moore, former director of the Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections, said this is a lifelong sentence for someone with mental illness, because what happened, no matter how long the sentence, when they get out, it's going to be very, very difficult to maneuver the community.
Yeah, Alisa Roth, what do they do? My proverbial question, what do they do in other countries? We know that we in prison, when you count jails and prisons in the United States, more people than everybody else in the world put together. What do they do elsewhere?
Well, I think that's part of it, that this issue of people with mental illness in the criminal justice system is partly part of our story of mass incarceration. So we need to lock up fewer people, for starters. I think that we need to figure out how to get people the mental health treatment that they need before it becomes an issue. So when you look at a country like Norway, for example, where people are getting health care throughout their lives, they have access to that mental health care throughout their lives, they're less likely to end up in jail or prison getting their first diagnosis. I spoke to a prisoner yesterday who has a diagnosis of schizophrenia. He said he was in his 20s when he had committed a murder, ended up in prison, and then was diagnosed with schizophrenia. So there's that disconnect between where people are getting diagnosed, where they're getting treatment, and then how they're ending up in the prison.
Randy in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Randy.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call. Sure. I just wondered if your guests could address the privatization of prisons and how that might affect this issue, because that seems to me that the whole purpose was to save money and that this would be pretty expensive.
David Singleton, any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I do have thoughts. Now, across the country, private prisons have proven disastrous in terms of ability to provide high quality services, and that's because they're motivated by profit. They're trying to trim as many costs from their budget as possible, and they skimp. And so the medical care and mental health care is worse in private prisons than it is in publicly managed prisons. Luckily, in Ohio, we have largely avoided the scourge of private prisons. We have a couple of privately operated facilities of our 32 institutions. Mm-hmm. Only a couple are privately operated, and so I think it's largely not an issue in Ohio in terms of privatization, but across the country, it is a huge problem where private prisons are more prevalent.
Lisa Roth.
Your concern is not so much the privatization of the prisons, but the privatization of the medical care. And so many, many prison systems will go outside to a private company to get the clinicians who are caring for their prisoners.
They contract out.
Exactly.
Okay.
And that's my concern, where the money comes into play. It's, you know, are those contractors getting paid enough that they can hire the clinicians that they should be hiring, that they can be getting the medications that they should be prescribing?
And Terry Russell in Ohio, they have their own operation, right? They're some of the highest paid employees of the state of Ohio.
They have their own staff available. Mm-hmm. And to be honest with you, again, because staff shortages, they can pay more than some of our community programs. So it's had an negative impact on our community programs. Mm-hmm. And there's one thing I do want to say about earlier the conversation. There is a correlation between the lack of mental health care and incarceration. Mental Health America just did a major study. We ranked 37th in the availability of care. And we have one of the highest populations
for
mental health care.
Overall,
yeah,
not just in the prisons. 37th,
grossly
yeah.
underfunded.
Yeah.
And there is a correlation then that we have one of the highest populations of mentally ill in our prisons. The issue is, and my guests may disagree with me on this, but I'm really concerned about stigma. 90% of people with a mental illness never commit a crime. No higher percentage than any other of the population. But every time there is a crime, there's high profile that person had a mental illness. Well, mm-hmm. you know, for that case, those that are committed the felony 1, 2, or 3, the major people shouldn't be on the streets that are going to commit crimes that hurt other
armed
people.
Armed robbery, murder.
All of those kinds of things.
Yeah.
Now,
right.
That group needs to be treated if they have a mental illness in the prison. And I think the system doesn't want to do that, but they have to. It's that other population of the 4s and 5s that could be diverted. And I really applaud the new governor and the legislature for looking at criminal justice reform. The citizens.
But the question is whether they're going to look at those issues.
Well, I think they will look at those issues. I happen to be on the Ohio Recovery Council. The governor appointed 16 people. And we're going to make sure that that's addressed. But the issue here is, how did we get to where we had 26,000 people in our state hospitals in 1963? Now we have 1,200. And we have 26,000 people in our jails and prisons that have a mental illness. We just changed one institution to another.
Right.
And that's got to be changed, especially at the jail level. And I'd like to – we'll talk about that later, but mm-hmm. the
yeah.
jails are a major problem.
It's
a,
because they turn over so fast and they're not there long enough to implement any kind of treatment programs. I want to turn to Lynn in Columbus. You're on the air. Hi, Lynn.
Good morning. Yes, I wanted to share an experience that I've had with my son being incarcerated. He had a traumatic brain injury from a car accident, and he went into the system, and that when they go into CRC, they can, if they even have a mental illness, a lot of the inmates will say, I don't have one, or they'll answer the questions in a certain way that they, so they can get to the prison faster, because in CRC, you're locked down 23 hours a day, I believe. When you get to the prison, you have more freedom. So they don't want to be in CRC any longer than they have to be.
And, Lynn, CRC is the...
Correctional. I forget what it stands for. Correctional Rehabilitation Center. And all of the people that in Ohio that are in jail before they go to prison, they all go collectively to CRC in Orient, Ohio.
Right.
And then they get shipped out to the different prison.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where they do all the evaluation. And one of your speakers was mentioning that earlier today. But,
and they just want to get out of there, and they expedite it by not maybe sharing.
Correct. And so that's an issue. Plus, again, it just doesn't seem that there is enough resources. And I agree with the other comments that were made. When we closed all of the mental health facilities, we just changed one institution for another. So I appreciate the validation that I've heard today. But again, my son was caught up in this situation, yeah. And it's an eye-opener.
Where is he now?
He is in Noble County, 2 hours away from my house. He had a probation violation. And so he'll be getting out Sunday, finally. But what failed is from the very beginning, with the mental health issue, the lawyer didn't help. The police didn't help. It's just there's got to be a lot more training at the police level, even at the people that represent them. And then we constantly fail these individuals for getting the help that they need.
Alisa Roth, I mean, what about that? What about the obligations of defense attorneys, arresting officers, the whole thing? I mean, it's a systemic problem, is it not?
It is absolutely a systemic problem. And I think that we are all, as a society, responsible for doing the best that we possibly can for these members of our society who most need our help. And so, absolutely, the defense attorneys and the prosecutors and the judges are on the front line of this, the law enforcement officers, and they need to be trained to recognize these other issues and then have options for how to deal with somebody who has a mental illness or who has a traumatic brain injury, who that's if not causing their behavior directly, at least affecting the outcome.
Because of the inadequacy of the prison system to treat people with mental illness, before I let you go, Alisa Roth, do you have any sense about what this is costing us as a society? So we know we saved money back 30 or 40, back in the 80s when we shut down the institutions, residential institutions for people with mental illness. What is it costing us now at the other end?
I mean, we know that keeping somebody in jail or prison is terribly expensive. We know that the cost to society, if you spread it over the course of somebody's lifetime, is terribly expensive, and so there's no question that this is the most expensive option that we could choose. The question is, are people willing to put taxpayer money back on the front end and figure out how to get people the care that they need, how to help them get the housing that they need, all those things that would keep them from ending up at the jail and prison end of things.
And David Singleton, before I let you go, one thing that it seems like we're talking a lot about men and men who are institutionalized, but I saw a statistic that said that something like 75% of women in prisons suffer from mental illness. So this isn't just... Go ahead.
Yeah, that is exactly right, and I'm glad you brought that up. I meant to bring that up earlier. And, we have a women's project here that represents women who are incarcerated, and there are a lot more of them who have serious mental illness that's not getting addressed adequately.
Well, anyways, David Singleton, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
David Singleton is executive director and attorney at Ohio Justice and Policy Center. That's an organization that advocates on behalf of people affected by the criminal justice system. Alisa Roth is a journalist and author of the 2018 book, Insane, America's Criminal Treatment of Mental Illness. Alisa Roth, thanks to you as well.
You're welcome.
We'll continue our conversation with Terry Russell, Executive Director of National Alliance on Mental Illness, and talk about maybe upfront what can be done better in Ohio, at least. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Managing mental health treatments in prisons remains a challenge in Ohio and across the country, where more than half of all inmates suffer from some kind of mental illness. And as we mentioned earlier, 75% of female inmates do. Today, we're talking about the quality of care for inmates with mental illness, and we're going to kind of move into the pre-period, you know, before you're arrested, before you're incarcerated. What can we be doing to avoid these kinds of challenges? Still with us is Executive Director of National Alliance on Mental Illness Ohio, Terry Russell. Listeners, we did invite the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Correction to join the show. They declined our request. If you have a question or comment, a personal experience, give us a call. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So let's talk, Terry Russell, about kind of the very front end of this, which is, you know, when somebody, even if they're getting treatment, even if they have a supportive family, they can still be out there. Something can go wrong. They create a problem and they get arrested. What about that front end piece of this?
That's exactly where we have to put our attention. We are very fortunate here in Ohio that we've been able to receive funding to train police officers, over 12,000 police officers, in crisis intervention training. So when they're called in to a case where someone with a mental illness is having difficulty, that they can de-escalate that situation. And it's been a tremendous success. 40 hours of training, by the way. It's an intense training.
Tell me, what do you do?
Well, the de-escalation is a technique, and that's trained by people who have worked in this area for a long time. But more importantly, it gives the family feeling that, and we always ask families, and we urge everybody else out listening here today, that if you have a loved one that has a mental illness and you call the police, ask for a trained CIT officer so that person can work with that individual, because they have the experience of working with others with these same behaviors and talking the person down before there's some escalation that ends, that person ends up in the wrong place.
Do you, you know, that kind of interaction was highlighted in the award-winning film Silver Linings Playbook.
Absolutely.
Was that a good representation of what you're talking about?
Absolutely. Okay. I think that really did demonstrate that there are all alternatives. You know, I took some of my board members 3 years ago down to San Antonio, Texas, look at a program there, a program that diverts people from the jails. And in two-year period, they had diverted over 600 people with a mental illness away from the jails, never got booked, and were treated right there. We are now looking all over the state, and we're recommending to the legislature as we speak, a crisis centers be developed. Right now, when a person's in crisis with a mental illness, what happens? They're either, the police are called and they get involved with the police and go to jail, or the jail takes them to this emergency rooms. The emergency rooms are ill-equipped. Mm-hmm. Believe this or not, I had an individual not very long ago. We receive a lot of calls with people asking, begging for treatment. And I had a 18-year-old who had slit his wrist trying to attempt of suicide. Mm-hmm. The mother took him to an emergency room, and he was, when they called me and got to me somehow from another city, they'd sat there 40 hours. And that's not uncommon. If that was just one isolated case, it's not uncommon that with a mental illness, there's nothing the emergency rooms can do to get them into care. So what we're looking for is an alternative where they can go and spend a period of time, and either in a longer period of time.
Kind of like a mental health emergency room?
Absolutely. That's exactly what it is. And it could be run by a hospital. But what we're saying is there has to be an alternative to what we have now for these crisis situations. Because we can de-escalate the emergency and then get to the core of helping that person. And then what is required there is a number of alternatives. When we closed the state hospitals, we were promised a community support system.
Mm-hmm.
And community support is just like all of us need. We need a place to live. We want to work. We need money.
Was it just they shut down the institutions? What did they think was going to happen back then?
Well, 70% of the people that were in the institutions were elderly, and 70% went to nursing homes. It's the new group that now, you know, I saw a report on this commission I'm on. I saw a report the other day. In 1963, we had 26,663 people in our state hospitals. 26,663. Today, we have 1,200. And about 700 of those are forensic that the courts have required the person to go in. So we only have 400 civil commitments. We had 26,000. And what was alarming in that report, of that 26,000, one-fourth had been there over 20 years.
Now, we were kind of that warehousing.
We were warehousing. But that's what people said. But the fact is that those people, they may have been warehoused, but the fact is there was nothing in the community that would keep them in harm's way, that keep them out of the situation we now, they get into trouble and end up in our jails and our prisons. That's the alternative that we have to find. We have to find ways of addressing those individuals who are not violent. You know, 24% of the people that go into our prisons today have never committed a crime before. 24%. So it's a situation that we can deal with if we have the commitment. And I'm seeing a little bit of that right now. As a matter of fact, I'm seeing a lot of it. You know, two-thirds of the population turned down the ballot issue for sentencing reform. That means that people, they want to punish people out there and not say they need to go into treatment. But I think the legislature is saying, wait a minute, there was part of it we didn't approve of, but there's part that we could look at, especially felonies fours and fives that could go to a misdemeanor. And if we go to a misdemeanor, we can certainly justify more treatment.
We can justify it, but who's going to pay for it? There's already a shortage.
First of all, it's saving. Okay. It's saving. I have a couple of just examples that I thought were interesting that we know of. An individual stole two plums and three candy bars and spent 135 days in our jails at $19,000. That's what it cost us. Now, if we took that $19,000, half of that $19,000, and put it into housing projects, supportive housing, restoration centers, rehabilitation centers. You know, we just did something in Athens, Ohio, an Adam Amanda Rehabilitation Center, where we, just like any other illness, when my father had a stroke, he was in the hospital 4 days, and that's the other big problem. When we go to the hospital, we get kicked out before we're ready to come back into the community. But after 4 days, went to a rehabilitation center for 30 days mm-hmm. and came back and lived a pretty productive life. We could do the same thing with mental illness. We did one in Athens, and we're going to try to get as many of these rehabilitation centers as we can, where a person goes into a hospital for their crisis, stays the short period of time, and then can go to a place for 60 to 90 days. And day one in that program, start looking what's going to happen when they're released. Right now, we send a lot of people to homeless shelters. My God, why in the world would we spend $8,000 or $9,000 or $10,000 in a hospital and then refer that person to a homeless shelter? You know that it was a waste of $8,000. So there are ways of transferring. I say, and people get mad at me for saying it, it may not be increased money. Now, there needs to be increased money. We're 37th in the state in supporting mental health. But mm-hmm. we could surely transfer some funds now being used in the prisons, being used in jails. You know, the sheriffs have come to our organization time.
Yeah, the jails are a huge issue because of that. We mentioned earlier, you're not in jail for that long, so what do you do?
And unfortunately, some jails in the state, although it's getting better, they won't medicate clients while they're in the jail. So they get off their medications.
Why won't they medicate in jail?
Well, it's expensive. Okay. And you when you go to jail, you lose your insurance. You lose Medicaid. So there's nobody to pay for it. That's federal rule, which is ridiculous. It's discriminatory. It's also discriminatory in the housing right now. When you go to any of these metropolitan housing programs where they pay a subsidy to let people live, you can't go to them if you have a criminal background. Why?
And I mean, your criminal background is a result of a mental illness, it's a catch-22.
It's a catch-22, and you're going to get worse.
Oliver in Springfield, you're on the air. Hi, Oliver.
Yeah. I just wondered, you know, is there any way that you can look into the prison system about a person being incarcerated for 17 years and not be that he had mental issues? And I know that they haven't been addressed right because he still has them.
Who is this?
It's my brother. His name is...
Well, we don't need his name, but tell me this. What's his mental illness?
Well, I believe it is because he's trying to kill himself.
And what was he convicted of?
Yeah, murder.
Okay. That's pretty serious. I mean, but you're saying he's also got a mental illness. Terry Russell wrote about situations like that.
You know, again, as I said earlier, people that commit murder, and by the way, of the 50,000 and we have in the hospital, there's only about, we see 10,000 of severely mentally disabled, but 4,000 of those are felony fours and fives. They're not murders. From the murder, for those who do these crimes that need to be incarcerated because they wouldn't be safe in your community, then let's find an alternative to putting them in solitary confinement. Let's find an alternative to not treating them while they're there and being with the rest. By the way, they get preyed upon because of their illness if they're with the regular population. So I think we can do, and we do. There are some programs in the prisons that are just tremendous. They've got dorms in prisons for those with a mental illness and work with them in a number of therapies and make their life as best as possible. But he probably will not get out with a murder conviction.
Right. And when you're in there for life, or for a long period of time, like Oliver's brother probably is.
Right.
Is there any sense about whether or not they get more help or they get less help? Is there a sweet spot for people who are serving time in prison who have mental illness?
I think it's just a moral responsibility that we give them the most help we can, understanding there are limitations. But there are ways, and the prison system has recognized this. They do have special programs for those who are going to be incarcerated for a long period of time for their mental illness. It's really that the group that are there for some minor, less degree of severity that we need to look at, and the treatment cannot happen appropriately in a prison. We need to get them into an alternative to that out in the community. And that could be a locked facility, by the way, but it's something different than being in a prison with all the other inmates.
Do we know or have any sense about how many people are in prison for drug-related offenses that are a function of the addiction, a function of mental illness?
My expertise isn't in that area, but we feel that's probably as great or greater than mental illness.
Okay.
The addiction. Probably well over 50% of the people in prisons having an addiction problem.
But the addiction problem may stem in part from mental illness, self-medication, that kind of thing.
For some, that's true.
Well, Terry Russell, Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness Ohio, thanks for joining us today.
Always love it.
Thanks to everybody else for your calls. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.